I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of September. The first Monday in October will be here before we know it, which means, of course, the Supreme Court will be in session again. We hope in just a few moments to be speaking with Adam Liptak. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. A lawyer he is, and he began covering the court in the fall of 2008. His series on the ways the U.S. legal system differs from those of other developed nations. American Exception was a finalist for the 2009 Pulitzer. And we'll be looking in some depth at the case of Foster v. Humphrey. It regards Georgia prosecutors' use of peremptory challenges to strike every black juror in the jury pool in the defendant's case. The 18-year-old defendant, Timothy Tyrone Foster, was convicted of the murder of a white woman by the all-white jury who sentenced him to death. He was convicted in 87, 1 year after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Equal Protection Clause forbids the prosecutor to challenge potential jurors solely on account of their race or on the assumption that black jurors as a group will be unable impartially to consider the state's case against a black defendant. So we will look at that. And what's also interesting is that when the term opens, five of the 34 cases in which the court has granted review involve Eighth Amendment issues, four of them the death penalty, and all five cases will be argued in the first three argument weeks of the term, four in October and the fifth early in November. So we'll be looking at the death penalty as well in the cases that the court will be taking up. So we hope that conversation will happen soon as we try to locate our guests. So bear with me here for a moment as we figure out what to do. Hour two of our show this Monday, the Milwaukee Film Festival, which is really huge and quite spectacular, will open this weekend. And we're going to talk with the producer of a film on homelessness in Milwaukee. The film is titled 30 Seconds Away, Breaking the Cycle. And the producer of the film and the director of the film spent 5 years talking with people who are homeless in Milwaukee in various places and finding out why people are homeless, why it's so hard to deal with mental illness. They looked at a special Milwaukee police unit that does outreach quite effectively to the homeless in this city. We'll look at shelters and why some people prefer to stay on the streets when family members can help, or why they are frequently not talked to by homeless people, other family members, for a long period of time. It's a really very sad and very direct look at a problem that most people don't look at. So that will be coming up during hour number two of our program today. We don't have our guest yet, so let me give you one more announcement, and then we'll figure out what to do. As you well know by now, he's been getting so much media coverage. Pope Francis is in the United States, and tomorrow at 9 o'clock we'll have live coverage of his address to Congress, much anticipated address. It will be hosted by Morning Edition Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, and it will feature commentary and analysis by NPR's Rome correspondent, Sylvia Pajoli, who is traveling with the Pope. NPR's religion correspondent will also be part of the discussion, and the congressional correspondents, Elsa Chang and Sue Davis, will be analyzing what the Pope has to say. The Pope's address to Congress tomorrow at 9 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. So that will be something that many people are paying attention to this. You'll want to hear. And tomorrow we will be talking about what the Pope had to say and his whole experience here in the United States with Father Thomas Reeves, who you probably have seen on television a good deal today if you're following this coverage. And he is a Jesuit, and he will be with us to talk about what the Pope has to say. He writes for a Catholic newspaper, and we'll have an interesting conversation and welcome your response to what the Pope has to say when he's here. And why it is that so many people are listening to him. What is it about this Pope that has thousands and thousands of people greeting him and thousands of people awaiting what he has to say on a variety of issues. So all of that is coming up. In the meantime, here we are, and we don't quite have a guest yet. And so we're going to have to do, well, we try to reach him, and I can guarantee you that everybody's trying to reach at him. We're going to get a message here, so, 30 seconds. We'll have him in 30 seconds. Oh, great. We'll have him in 30 seconds, so we don't have to do an open line. But I can give you the phone number as we talk about the Supreme Court. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to speak with Adam Liptek, Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also reach us on Twitter, and that will be at K Dunn Show. So we welcome your calls on the Supreme Court and what they'll be talking about during their next session, which always begins the first Monday in October. And evidently they review some cases too during the summertime, so Adam will be up to date as to what might be on their agenda that we don't know very much about because it's just come to their attention, and what decisions have been made to add new things to their deliberations during their new session. So we will get some news as well. So that's what's going on this hour. And we're ready with Adam, which is good to know. Hi, Adam. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. All right, let's dive right into the Supreme Court case of Foster v. Humphrey regarding Georgia prosecutors' use of peremptory challenges. This is a fairly old murder case, isn't it? Why is it surfacing now and finding its way to the Supreme Court?
It's a post-conviction challenge, and it asks the court to take another look at an area that no one's been very satisfied with, which is what do you do when prosecutors knock lots of blacks off of juries? The Supreme Court had said that's no good, that's race discrimination, but then it says all a prosecutor has to do is come up with a race-neutral reason. And it turns out that just about any reason will do. Prosecutors have gotten very good at coming up with a reason like the person didn't look them in the eye, or they didn't look like the way they were dressed, or they had a beard. And this new case asked the court to take another look at that question about whether there shouldn't be some way to tighten up the standards for when you can knock minorities off of juries.
Mm-hmm. And we are looking at a 1987 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that it did address this issue of race in juries, didn't it?
Yes, that's the key case. It's called Batson, and it revised what had been centuries and centuries of practice, which allows prosecutors and defense lawyers a number, often a large number, in Louisiana, for instance, is a dozen, of so-called peremptory challenges. Peremptory challenges are challenges where you don't need a reason. You can knock someone off just because your gut tells you they're not going to be good for your case, you don't trust them. And the court in that Batson case for the first time said, well, race is different. We're not going to allow discriminatory motives, even in this context of peremptory challenges, the ones where you don't need a reason. And ever since then, no one's been quite satisfied with that ruling because it doesn't seem to have any teeth. It's very nice to say you can't have a discriminatory reason, but if all you do is have to come up with a race-neutral reason, prosecutors and defense lawyers have gotten pretty good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And this new case has facts where looks pretty clear that the prosecution was honed in on making sure there were no black people on the jury. In all kinds of forms, they put stars next to and highlighted the names of black jurors. They ranked black jurors in order of which ones would be the most and least desirable in a separate kind of ranking. So it seems fairly clear, I would guess, that the Supreme Court's going to do something about this particular case. The larger question is whether it does anything about the legal principles involved, about whether it wants to tighten up the rules for when you can systematically knock blacks off juries.
Mm-hmm. Is there a long history, Adam, of blacks being knocked off juries, particularly in the South?
There sure is. And, you know, on some level, it's rational. blacks have had long experience with the criminal justice system, are less likely to trust cops when they testify, are less likely often to trust prosecutors. It depends on communities and circumstances, of course. But the rational prosecutor, if they know nothing else about a juror, that they're black or white, might well prefer the white juror because the white juror might well have had better experiences with and a better view of law enforcement.
And you put this in the context of what we're dealing with now in America, as you write in one of your pieces, as police shootings of unarmed black men across the country have spurred distrust of law enforcement by many African Americans. You have to ask, and many are criminal juries warped by racism and bias?
Yeah, so it's a timely and difficult question for the Supreme Court. And it does fit in with this general national conversation we're having now about how law enforcement and the criminal justice system treats minorities. And, you know, jury service is one of the few ways in which everybody gets to take part in American civic and public life. Aside from voting, it's hard to say where else we interact directly, individually with the political injustice system. So it does seem to be a place where you want to make sure that everyone feels welcome.
Mm-hmm. What is the likelihood of an acquittal? You've done there. You cite an interesting study in your piece in the New York Times. How much does it rise with the number of blacks on the jury?
You know, the studies are not definitive, but they are suggestive, and they suggest that blacks are more likely to vote for acquittal, and that's consistent with this idea that that minorities, and again, This is an average, and it will vary by history and community and so on. But on average, blacks are a little less likely to take the word of law enforcement and a little more likely to vote for acquittal. And that looks like, and the studies are not definitive and the numbers are fairly small, but it looks like this rises in a straight line with the number of blacks on a jury. So if you have, in Louisiana, for instance, zero blacks on a jury, you're going to get no acquittals. And if you have five or more blacks on a jury, you might get a 20% acquittal rate.
Mm-hmm. Also, and I wonder how significant these numbers are, African Americans are less likely to favor the death penalty.
Well, that's quite significant, and in a couple of senses. Not only do you have the usual pattern that we've just been talking about, where if you have more blacks on a jury, you're more likely to have an acquittal, but the death penalty, as it's practiced in America, has a funny twist to it, which is you're only allowed to serve on a capital jury if you are, in the legal jargon, death qualified. Hmm. And what death qualified means is that you have to at least be open to the idea that you might impose the death penalty, that you don't have an absolute categorical position on the death penalty, that you would never impose it. If you're one of those people who would never impose it, and there are lots of blacks among them, you're not entitled to serve on the jury in the first place. So capital juries have both phenomenons. You have prosecutors perhaps knocking black people off because they might vote for acquittal, but having an absolute right to knock them off. They don't need to use a discretionary peremptory challenge if black folks, and they are more likely to say this, are categorically opposed to the death penalty.
Mm. You also cite the jury pool, that blacks are less likely to be on lists that are drawn from. Where are they drawn?
Well, they're often drawn from voter registration records or from driver's license records or sometimes from property records. And in all of those, and this varies some too, but in all of those, there's some reason to think that blacks are underrepresented. We've all been hearing about the difficulty of minorities being able to vote and perhaps being able to register to vote. Blacks may well, in many communities, be less likely to drive. And poor people and black people are often among poor people are also more transient, so it may be that recent property records don't pick them up. So for lots of reasons, blacks are vastly underrepresented in the jury registries to begin with. So that's even before we get to the question of who's knocked off a jury, The question is, are they in the jury pool generally, and they are underrepresented?
By who says what a jury is supposed to look like, and what is a jury supposed to look like?
Well, you hear this phrase that it's supposed to be a jury of your peers. That doesn't seem to appear anywhere, certainly not in the Constitution or in any foundational document. But you do have the general sense that it's supposed to reflect the community. It's the community's voice in the criminal justice determination, and that you would hope and you would think that it's a fair cross-section of the community. And it doesn't always seem to be that.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the death penalty for a moment, I have read that when the term opens on October 5, five of the 34 cases in which the court has granted review do involve Eighth Amendment issues, and four of them involve the death penalty. Can you talk more about that, Adam?
The court has always been active in death cases, and this term it seems to be even more so. The last term that ended in June, on the very last day of the term, Justice Stephen Breyer, joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, announced for the first time that they are very skeptical about whether the death penalty is constitutional. Hmm. So that was a major change, a shift in on the current court, two justices coming very close to announcing that they're prepared to vote against the death penalty. I don't think they have five votes, but it's from their perspective a start. And the court will this term look at Florida's sentencing scheme and ask whether juries have a large enough role in deciding who gets put to death, and look at a number of individualized cases about whether people were convicted fairly in the death context. The court feels that it has to be very active in something so final. So it doesn't often review an ordinary criminal conviction just because something might have gone wrong. The court doesn't view itself as a court of error correction. It generally wants to establish broad legal principles. But in the case of death, it often scrutinizes individual cases quite closely.
And was this the first time that Breyer and Ginsburg were public about their views concerning the death penalty?
Yes, that's right. It does seem that as justices on the liberal side of the court spend a long time looking at these cases, they often come around to the view that they will, in Justice Blackmun's words, no longer tinker with the machinery of death. So you saw, they're all gone from the court now, but you saw earlier justices, Brennan, Marshall, Blackmun, toward the very end of his run, Justice Stevens, all announcing or coming close to announcing that they believe the death penalty is too arbitrary, too prone to error, too racially discriminatory to be constitutional, and now you have on the current court for the first time two more justices getting very close to that position.
Interesting. Going back to Timothy Tyrone Foster and this 1987 case, why is it, Adam, that it has taken so long for this appeal to get to the U.S. Supreme Court? This is a lot of years.
It is, but you know, in death cases, it's not at all unusual. They often take decades. In this case, there are multiple layers of review. So there's, first of all, the trial that I feel fairly sure was retried. Then it's appealed up to the state system. Then the state courts take a second look at it on post-conviction review. Then it moves to the federal courts, and the federal courts look at cases on so-called habeas corpus review. So it's not so unusual. It takes a long time. And in this case, it wasn't until a decade after the original trial that the prosecutor's notes emerged, and those notes are very strongly suggestive of racially discriminatory motives on the part of the prosecution in knocking blacks off of juries. So, yes, it sounds like forever, but it's not unusual. The average person on death row has been there in California, for instance, for 25 years. They're more likely to die of natural causes than they are to be executed. So one kind of objection to the capital justice system is that it's too expensive, it takes too long, and Justice Breyer even has the view that being on death row for that length of time is itself a kind of human rights violation of having to wake up every morning thinking you might soon be executed. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to execute somebody a month after trial. It's another to execute them after decades.
Mm-hmm. And where were those prosecutors' notes for 10 whole years?
They were in the files. it may well be that they should have been disclosed on day one, but for whatever reason, it took a long time and litigation and Public Records Act requests for the evidence to emerge.
And this whole peremptory challenge is kind of interesting. When you say you can get rid of somebody for just a gut reason, if you don't like somebody's beard, if you don't like the way they're dressed, or as you say in one of your articles, if you're too rich or you're too poor, you're too educated or you're not educated, it seems so terribly willy-nilly. Isn't there something wrong with that?
Well, that is the average civilian's gut reaction. But it doesn't seem to be the average lawyer's gut reaction. Peremptory challenges have a history in the common law going back into the English roots of the common law. And many lawyers on both sides, prosecutors and defense lawyers, say that they need to be able to shape the jury a little bit, that they're only going to get a fair trial if they can get rid of that person who they just know in their guts is some crazy person. And they can't put their finger on it, but they just know their client's not going to get a fair trial before that juror. And as I reported that piece, I went into it thinking, well, maybe we should just do what some people have suggested, get rid of peremptory challenges, retain challenges for cause, where you go to the judge and have to give a good reason for why you want to get rid of somebody. And lawyers on both sides, including defense lawyers, were adamant when they talked to me that peremptories were a good idea. Now, some of them did say that maybe you don't need 10 or 12. Maybe it's enough to have two or three. Get rid of that, get rid of that person who you just know in your gut is not going to work out for you. But don't allow people to spend days questioning potential jurors closely and knocking them off on all kinds of grounds, perhaps including racially discriminatory grounds.
Mm-hmm. And a judge can get rid of potential jurors, too? How does that work?
Right. So there are two kinds of challenges. The peremptory we've been talking about, which is completely discretionary, which is just up to the lawyer, generally doesn't need to offer any kind of reason. And then there's the more traditional and kind of obvious challenge for cause, where you say to the judge, listen, this person is married to the defendant. This person goes to church with the defendant. This person has himself or herself been the victim of this very same kind of crime. They just can't be fair, Your Honor. And then the judge can decide whether to grant that challenge because the judge has heard what may or may not be a good reason. I don't think anybody has a problem with that kind of challenge, the so-called for-cause challenge.
Right.
But lawyers say that they either can't quite articulate why or they don't trust judges to be responsive enough to those kinds of requests.
Adam Lutzak is our guest. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and they will begin their session first Monday in October. We have been talking about this peremptory challenge case. It's an interesting one, Foster v. Humphrey, Georgia prosecutors' use of peremptory challenges to strike every black juror in the jury pool in the defendant's case. The 18-year-old Timothy Tyrone Foster, his name, was convicted of the murder of a white woman by the all-white jury. He was sentenced to death, convicted in 1987. And then it was discovered that the prosecution in the case had marked the name of each black prospective juror in green highlighter, circled the word black next to the race question on the juror questionnaire of five black prospective jurors, identified three black prospective jurors as B number one, B number two, and B number three, and then rank them, as Adam writes in his piece in the New York Times, against each other in case it came down to having to pick one of the black jurors. So we are looking at how this squares with a Supreme Court decision in 1987, the Equal Protection Clause forbidding the prosecutor to challenge potential jurors solely on account of their race. We're also looking at some of the other cases the Supreme Court will be taking up when they resume. And the death penalty is one, as Adam said, Breyers and Ginsburg have said at the end of the last session in June that they had serious questions about the death penalty, and they're taking up a lot of death penalty-related cases in the new term. Is this an indication? He says there aren't five votes there, but is it an indication that the death penalty may at some point be on the way out in this country? And what do you think about peremptory challenges? It is kind of a strange system. If you've ever been knocked off a jury, haven't you wondered, why didn't they pick me? Well, here's how you reach this conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to hear your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. We're talking about the Supreme Court and peremptory challenges and some issues beyond that this hour with Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. And we start our calls with Joe in central Wisconsin. Hi, Joe.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi.
It's a fascinating topic and really something I had never had any personal knowledge of, but I was just wondering for clarification. Your guest was talking about having more African-Americans on the jury would increase the likelihood of an acquittal. But did that also, was there any kind of data drawn between that and the ethnicity of the defendant?
Good question, Adam.
That's an excellent question. And I don't have data on it, but I have talked to a bunch of lawyers, defense lawyers and prosecutors, and they think that that matters, that one prosecutor I talked to in Louisiana said, well, listen, yes, sure, we have a black defendant, black jury, but we also have a black victim. And sometimes we have a black prosecutor. And if a black prosecutor is speaking up for the black victim, you might have a different set of cross currents. And it may well matter to a jury whom they identify with in that courtroom or in that case. So I don't have data on it, but I think the questioner is quite right, that if the only thing you know is a black defendant caught up in the criminal justice system, you might have one sort of response. But if you have a number of black players in the courtroom, you might have a different kind of response.
Hmm. Anything else, Joe?
Well, the reason that I'm kind of thinking of this is because I'm a pro se defendant in a obstruction of justice case, and it has been going on for about a year and a half now, and I really, before this happened, I was totally unaware of how broken our system is, but after being in it for a year and a half, I realized that there are some serious issues within the system, and that it seems to me it has more something to do with the economic impacts than it does actually the right and the wrong of it. And it strikes me that it seems that we're over time drifting away from that common law principle that a person who hasn't harmed anyone, hasn't taken anyone's property, hasn't committed fraud, finds themselves in a very difficult situation with a system that is geared against them. And I know, unfortunately, the minority community bears the brunt of this, but I don't think it is something specific to them, as my own experience is a very tragic one. I literally was minding my own business, and because the officer lost one defendant, he decided that I would be the next. it's too complicated to really go into, but they have absolutely no evidence against me, but they have totally refused to drop the case, and it will now proceed to a jury trial, hence my motivation to find out the demographic of the jury and the defendant.
Adam.
Well, one thing is for sure, a famous judge named Learned Hand said that short of grave illness, there's probably nothing he would like less than to be involved as a litigant or a defendant in a lawsuit. It's an all-consuming, terrifying fight against the power of the state. So I'm sympathetic to Joe. I don't know a thing about the merits of his case, but it is a it's a hell of a thing to go through.
I'm sure it is, yeah. Thank you, Joe, very much for your call. Charles in Madison is next. Hi, Charles.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm a former prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney. I've got about 35 years of experience in our courts here in Wisconsin. I was calling to just say that I agree that the peremptory challenge is very important to having a fair trial, especially here in Wisconsin, where, for instance, the fact that somebody is a police officer doesn't mean that they would be stricken for cause, even though they are much more likely to believe the testimony of police officers than non-police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I can also say that...
Hello, Charles?
The reality is that our criminal justice system has become almost a processing rather than a winnowing of cases. And although there's a technical presumption of innocence, the reality is throughout the whole process, except possibly during the
I'm sorry, your phone is kind of cutting in and out, but we got the gist of what you were saying earlier. Adam.
Yeah, so that's a very representative point of view, and I'm glad the caller made it. The people involved in the system, the lawyer and the caller said he's been both a prosecutor and defense lawyers, really think peremptories have an important role to play. The example he gave was that a police officer would not be stricken for cause. And, you know, that's a nice kind of thought experiment. Should a police officer in a case where another police officer will testify be knocked off for cause? I'm not sure what your intuition is. Mine is maybe that's mm-hmm. not enough. And yet if I'm a lawyer defending somebody in that case, I'm pretty sure I probably don't want that person on my jury.
Mm-hmm. And tell me again, is there a standard number of peremptory challenges you can make?
It varies by state.
Oh, it does?
Yes. So this is not a constitutional rule. Every state is different. In Louisiana, which I looked at pretty hard, it was a dozen. I think elsewhere it's 10. I don't know what the number is in Wisconsin. Some caller probably does know. But it tends to be fairly high. And jury selection in state courts will often go on for a day or two or three while jurors are closely questioned and people make lists and strategize. And it's a major part of a criminal trial. In federal court, it has a much, much smaller profile. So it varies by jurisdiction.
And we welcome phone calls. We're having other access problems, but you can call the show to speak with Adam. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The articles that you've written for the New York Times also highlight this continuing issue of racial justice and perceptions of the criminal justice system between African Americans and whites. And you talk about, and I can't remember if this was in Louisiana, Adam, or where, prospective jurors who are arriving at a courthouse that has outside of it a monument to the Confederacy.
Yes, that was it's the county courthouse in Shreveport, Louisiana, Caddo Parish. And that courthouse was once upon a time the capital of that part of the Confederacy. And in front of the courthouse is a large monument with four Confederate generals on it. And on the one hand, and this is true throughout the South, it's part of the state's history. On the other hand, there are black jurors who think that sends a terrible message of racial supremacy that is not what you want as you're walking into a courthouse.
Right, I wouldn't think so.
It's meant to be dedicated to equal justice under law. And the Louisiana Supreme Court did suggest that the courthouse should take down the Confederate flag in 2010, and it did that. The monument, though, remains there, and in fairness to them, the logistics of getting such a large monument out, even if they were inclined to do that, is not so easy. But it does make at least some black jurors uneasy about the role that they're about to play as they stroll by these Confederate generals.
When you look at the, and you've covered the court system for some time now, when you look at what ideal juries are, does it vary dramatically from defendant to prosecutor?
I'm not sure I adopt what's an ideal jury, but each side has very different wishes. There are people who are inclined to be pro-prosecution. There are people who are inclined to agree with one sort of evidence over another. And seasoned lawyers who practiced for 20 and 30 years have a very, very good idea of what kind of jury they want. What a juror's understanding of these vague phrases like proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, you can really put a lot of stress on a different word in that phrase and come to a different conclusion about how you're going to evaluate the evidence. And so people who participate in the criminal justice system really think it's important to have a chance to look people in the eye and get a sense of whether their client's going to get a fair shake. And that sense is going to vary dramatically between prosecutors and defense lawyers.
Mm-hmm. When does the Supreme Court take up this particular case that we've been discussing, Adam? Early in the session?
Yeah, I think it's in the November sitting we're going to hear this case. And it's not a particularly hard case. As I suggested before, I think the defendant's chances of winning are pretty good. The harder, more interesting question is whether the court does something with that 1987 case you mentioned, Batson, to tighten up the standards, because you're not going to have a lot of cases where the prosecutor's notes actually show,
right,
seem to show that there was racial discrimination.
Right, even though for whatever reason nobody could find him for 10 years. And when you say tighten up, that would mean what?
Well, it's a little hard to know exactly how you do it, but I guess the basic dynamic is this. In peremptory challenges, you don't have to offer a reason. If you strike, you know, lots of black people, the defense lawyer may say, wait a second, I see a pattern of race discrimination here, judge. Please make the prosecutor say his reasons. And then the prosecutor gives reasons, and just about any reason will do. And I guess the place the court might tighten it up is to instruct judges to be a little more skeptical about whether these after-the-fact supposedly race-neutral reasons are really the reasons. And how exactly you do that, I'm not sure, but that's where the pressure point might seem to be.
Mm-hmm. Are there other cases? The Supreme Court had such a huge session last go around, all these major decisions that you particularly, I'm sure, were waiting and had tons and tons to write about. Anything of the magnitude of same-sex marriage?
No, but that's a once in a 20 or 30 year
right.
case. We'll have a reasonably active term already on the docket, and they will add cases as the term goes on, are major challenges to affirmative action in higher education, to public sector unions, and to how we decide the meaning of one person, one vote. So there are three cases that by any standard are major cases, and we may well in short order have an abortion case, which will be the first time since 2007 that the court has looked at abortion. And we may also have a kind of sequel to the Hobby Lobby case about the clash between religious freedom on the one hand and access to contraception on the other.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it'll be a pretty good term, but it won't be nothing like the
right.
terms in which we've had marriage and health care.
Well, at least you had that term, right? That was exciting for you.
And if I never have a June like the last one.
Oh, you might miss it, Adam. Let's talk more about those. What is the case looking at affirmative action? And the Supreme Court, at least for a while, hasn't been too favorably inclined toward affirmative action, has it?
Well, you know, it's taken a kind of middle ground. It said in a 2003 decision called Grutter that you cannot have quotas, you can't have numerical standards, Well, you can take account of race as one factor among many in deciding how to achieve a diverse student body so kids can learn better from each other because you have a bunch of perspectives in the classroom. So that seemed to be the compromise the court worked out in 2003, and we've lived with that compromise for some time now. In fact, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who has since retired, said she expected that compromise to hold for about 25 years. But we now have a court that's slightly more conservative, with Justice Alito replacing Justice O'Connor. And there are signs that this court is ready to ratchet back on that, to say that we should be colorblind, that at least public universities, which are arms of the government, shouldn't be making distinctions among prospective students, taking race into account even as a small factor, even as a plus factor. And I think there's some reason to think that in this new case, Fisher v. University of Texas, which the court is taking up for a second time, and that fact that it's coming up for a second time makes it seem even a little more ominous for supporters of affirmative action, that the court might be prepared to say that race can play no role in assembling student bodies.
Mm-hmm. Public sector unions?
The court is being asked to consider whether people represented by unions who work for the government but don't want to be part of the union, must they nevertheless pay fees equivalent to union dues? And the court has already said that, no, you don't have to if the union is engaging in political activities. You don't have to subsidize that if you're not a member of the union. But it is said also that straight collective bargaining activities can be required to require a so-called agency fee, an equivalent of dues, even if you're not a member of the union. And now the court is looking at a challenge, and here again, I think unions should be nervous, that even those collective bargaining activities might be the kind of thing that you can't force people to subsidize if they're not members of the union. And should the court rule that way, that would be a real body blow to public sector unions. Now, I know Wisconsin's had quite a bit of experience with this issue generally, but the court will be looking at it nationwide.
Yes. Have there been challenges to public unions ever since we had them? Or is this a new challenge to them?
So yes and no. The court in a 1977 case called Abood, it's sort of similar to what we were just talking about affirmative action. It sort of worked out this compromise. You don't have to subsidize if you don't want to the political activities. You do have to pay for the collective bargaining activities on your behalf. And we've lived with that for a long time. But this new court, again, with Justice Alito playing a key role, has twice suggested that it's open to a challenge to that second part, the collective bargaining part. And a few terms ago in a case called Knox, and again 2 terms ago in a case called Harris v. Quinn, Justice Alito, in almost so many words, says, bring me a case. Let's tee this up. Let's decide whether we're going to overrule that old case called Abood. And, you know, it looks pretty bad for unions. We'll see. I mean, a lot of times the early signals are in one direction, and by the time the court reads the briefs, hears the arguments, it goes in a different direction. But this could be another one of those cases where conservatives might end up being happy with this court.
And what would it do to unions, Adam?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. Just because you're allowed not to pay for collective bargaining activities, you may, out of the goodness of your heart, continue to pay for them. But economists would suggest that if you can take a free ride on other people's dues, maybe you won't if you're not required to pay the equivalent fees yourself. So it may be that unions get less money, and unions with less money have less power.
Adam Liptak is our guest this hour. He is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. We're now looking at the issues before the court as they resume on October 5th. Our phone number, and we have time for a couple more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Email, everything's up and running again now, just to let you know. Thumbs up, Scotty says. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Adam, Jake, and Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. I have 2 questions. The first is, earlier you were talking about the on that appeal case, the prosecutor notes indicated B1, B2, B3. Mm-hmm. How in the world can one get a hold of a prosecutor's notes on a case? And the reverse, the opposite side of that, the defendant's attorney's notes. I mean, to me, that would seem to be privileged information.
So you're quite right on the defendant's side. On the prosecution side, there's much more leeway. They're obliged to disclose all sorts of material that can be helpful to the defense, both before and after trial. They're subject often to public records laws, so that's not so unusual that that kind of evidence does tend to emerge before and after the fact. There's a case called Brady that requires the prosecution to disclose all sorts of materials.
Okay. Second question is DNA evidence ever challenged in court?
If I understand I think I understand the question, and the answer is yes. I mean, DNA evidence is on one level foolproof if properly understood, but on another level, it can be misinterpreted, and there's oftentimes lots of litigation surrounding what the right interpretation of DNA evidence is.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Jake. I was interested, Adam, in this 2009 series that you did, or 2009 American Exception. When you look at it, as you have, the legal system in other developed nations, are we a shining light or not?
We're different from the rest of the world in many, many ways. And it really depends a little bit on how you want to think about it. In some ways, we might be thought to be more liberal. In other ways, we're much more punitive than other parts of the world. We give criminal defendants many more procedural rights than many other developed countries do. But when we punish them very severely. We have an extremely large prison population. We have 5% of the world's population, 25% of its prisoners. We're also much more active than most of the world in using the death penalty, in using life without parole sentences. So it's a mixed bag, and it kind of depends where what your I'm not sure what to call it, what your criminal politics are.
Yeah. So is it still a thrill to cover the Supreme Court?
A thrill might be overstating it sometimes. It's often very technical. It's intellectually quite satisfying.
I'm
the
sure.
harder you work at it, the more interesting it becomes. It's not always easy to make compelling journalism out of some of these cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it, I was looking at the Supreme Court's statement of what they're taking up, and I could hardly understand what they were saying. The legal, it helps to be a lawyer, doesn't it?
Welcome to my world. It probably does help to be a lawyer. It probably does help that I am a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm sure that it does help that you're a lawyer. Well, thank you very, very much for being with us, Adam. And
great pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, have a good new season of the court. Adam Liptak, our guest this hour. Adam is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times and has written some very interesting pieces. I find this one fascinating. It's the Foster versus Humphrey. We spent a lot of time this hour talking about it, the Georgia prosecutor's use of peremptory challenges, but it brings to mind all of the peremptory challenges too, and whether or not there's something wrong with that, or most prosecutors and defenders say that they kind of like that. You have a gut instinct about somebody. In this particular case that the Supreme Court is taking up, they got rid of every single potential black juror, and race was definitely a consideration here, and it shouldn't have been based on an earlier ruling by the Supreme Court in 1987. So, new session will begin October 5. We'll talk about other decisions or other deliberations of the court as the weeks go by. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where it is another beautiful day. Hasn't it been a week? It's just beautiful. Every day it's just beautiful. So we have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return and talk about this very moving and important film on homelessness in the city of Milwaukee, part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. So stay with us.